Today I'm with Steve Lonzi, and I discovered him on LinkedIn when he was walking around some beautiful garden in, I believe, in Los Angeles, and he had a positive message for life, which is like completely rare. So how do you stay so positive in life these days?
How do I stay? Hey, that's a really good question. You know, I've generally, by nature, a fairly upbeat, positive person. But, you know, the thing is, I follow this philosophy, and this philosophy is called carefreeness. And basically, just the very essence, I'll just give it to you really quick. So carefreeness is how you create your life, okay? It relates to what you do and how you, in turn, based on your reactions and actions, create your life. So very simply, carefreeness is your life is created by your reactions to things. All right. It's not the things that happen to you that make your life up, but it's the way you react to what happens to you that makes your life. So adopting this philosophy, which is very empowering for me, puts me in control of my life. And I think that when you're in control of your life, you're a much happier person, a more upbeat person, and a more positive person. So I try to move forward with this kind of responsibility that I have, understanding that every reaction that I'm giving to everything that's going on around me is creating the life that I'm ultimately going to have or the life that I'm having. So once I understood that and once I got rid of all the excuses, because people tend to think that life is something that happens to them as opposed to, you know, something that they can actually affect or control. And once I realized that, I started taking more control of my life. And once I started to take more control of my life, I started to be more happy and more positive about things because I started to see better results in what I was doing. And I think that's very important because I think, you know, a lot of, let's say, self-help gurus or people that, you know, on the internet or what have you, a podcast, they sort of say, like, you know, you just need to be positive, right? You should just go out there and be positive, which is which after a while, if you don't have a supporting evidence of why you should be positive, it's not going to fully take hold because you don't really want to be pretending you're positive. You can create it until you make it, which is kind of how I describe that. But ultimately, you're going to want to see some success points along the way. So, so in how I approach life, I'm taking stock of my achievements and I'm trying to sort of, recognize the progress I'm making and then trying to be grateful about everything in the moment. So, gratefulness is another tool that I use, to stay positive, right? Because when you're grateful about your situation, you're understanding that actually, you know, I mean, there are people going off to war today, you know, in Ukraine. You were telling me about your father-in-law, which is very sad and it's very tragic that this war is happening. But, you know, I'm here in Los Angeles. I'm not fighting a war. So everything is basically a relative situation. And it's up to you to recognize how grateful you are for the situation you're in. You know, even people who are fighting the war are grateful about certain things, but it's shifting that focus onto, because most of us have this, you know, our focus is on what we don't have, right? And I'm trying to shift the focus on what I do have and be happy and be grateful about what I do have. So that sort of puts things in a perspective that allows me to be more positive and more happy.
One of my friends on LinkedIn today, Dan Ramu, talking about how eagles, they only learn to fly when they're sort of kicked off the high perch and they're flying down the mountain. Sometimes I feel like myself, like I'm that eagle falling down this mountain, having to learn to fly because just through certain situations in life, it feels like that right now to me, you know?
I think a lot of people feel that way. I don't think you're alone. Especially in today's, you know, highly technological world where things are moving 10 times faster than ordinary, you know, they ordinarily move or did move in the past, perhaps. But yeah, it's a lot to take in. So there are habits, you know, that you need to, you don't need to do anything necessarily, but there are habits that you can adopt that will help you with proper framing. So, for example, in the morning when I wake up, You know, I'm paying attention to that voice that's inside my head talking to me all day long. Because that conversation you're having with that voice inside your head all day long, that's a really important conversation that you want to be gain some more awareness about. Because we don't really pay a lot of attention sometimes to what we're saying to ourselves and how at times destructive that might be. Okay, we're being critical of our actions. You know, we're saying a lot of things in this daily conversation. So when I wake up, I'm paying attention to that conversation in my mind. And the first conversation I'm having is this conversation about how grateful I am, you know, that I've woken up, I'm alive, I've got a full new day ahead of me where I can, you know, recreate myself in any way I want because it's a brand new day. So, you know, I'm starting with the right frame. I'm framing the right way, and I'm working on my story. And so my story is what that conversation is all about. So in other words, that conversation could be, oh man, you know, I'm going to Las Vegas, but I'm so unlucky when I gamble. Or, hey, I'm going to meet this girl on a date, but I'm so unlucky at love, right? It's like, that's your story because you're basing it on everything that's happened in the past. And then you're kind of creating it again as you move forward and you want to avoid doing that. So the way to do that is to pay attention to the story you're telling yourself. And the way to change that story effectively is to write it down in like a paragraph or two, but write it down in the positive. All right. And that's going to be your new story. And every day you want to recite that story. You want to record you saying that story. You want to maybe do it in front of a mirror when you do it. Right. Because you want it to impress on that's who you are. And when you say it as if you are that new person right now. You don't say I'm going to become this. You say, hey, I'm really lucky every time I go to Vegas, I leave with tons of money. Every time I go out on a date, the woman or the man who I meet, they're always interested in me. They always want to go on a second date, right? So you're sort of creating this reality. So then you start to reprogram your mind and your frame and your internal dialogue to start talking about that reality. And that in turn helps you then to start creating, to create that reality.
So it's basically you're training your subconscious, which you don't really have control with minute to minute, but it's something that can be, the neurological pathways can be over time strengthened in a positive way.
Exactly. And you actually do have control over it, but it's, you have to train yourself to gain the, it's really about awareness. Okay. So awareness is like the key to solving most problems. For example, if you're, let's say you're on a diet, one thing that people on a diet do, I mean, this is just a story I'll tell you. I was at lunch with a writer, very, very talented Hollywood A-list writer, and he brought a little scale to the lunch because, and he was a little overweight, so he was on a diet. So this diet that he was on required him to bring a little miniature scale to lunch. Okay, so he pulled out this scale and he started weighing all of his food before he ate it. He weighed it on the scale. Okay, now I know it sounds absurd, right? It sounds nutty, and maybe it was, but hey, it helped him lose a lot of weight. But what's really going on here? He's slowing down this process that, you know, feels like, you know, just this natural thing that we're doing, which is eating, which is obviously very natural thing. He's slowing it down and he's gaining awareness of how much he's eating, right? He's measuring it. So it would say, if you want to manage something, measure it. I forget exactly how that term goes, but if you want to manage it, measure it, right? So this is just about gaining awareness, and gaining awareness is the first like step into solving problems. You know, they say in problem solving, when you break down the problem solving, the tenets in problem solving, the first thing is recognize the problem. So that's what that is. It's recognizing exactly what the problem is first. That's the first thing you do. And the problem could be that he was eating too much food.
Yeah, it's so important with mental issues that you should share with other people, because that's the first step in overcoming any phobia like that. I found that personally. So,
yes, there might be underlying. Yeah, and by the way, I don't mean to suggest that dieting is as easy as just, you know, weighing your food. That was something that he did that was helpful for him. It wasn't all he was doing either. You know, it was just what I witnessed him doing out at lunch. But you're absolutely right. I think to really solve personal problems, personal issues, you really need to go deeper and try to figure out, you know, what is the cause. So the cause in his situation may partly have been about the amount of food he was eating, but I'm sure there may have been other causes that he was also trying to identify and work on.
Do you find that A-list actors are not very fun people to go out and eat with?
I find actors to be really engaging and seductive and likable, and they seem to have a quality that is really attractive. In my experience, when I've met actors, there's an allure to them that is hard to explain. That's really, really seductive, and it really kind of draws you in. So I find actors to be entertaining. Not all actors. Some actors, sometimes actors tend to be not who they are on screen. So sometimes there's maybe, you have an impression of how somebody might be, and then they're not that way at all. That's interesting. But no, I'd say for the most part, I think actors are generally very likable, very gregarious type of people. This particular gentleman was a writer, and writers tend to be a little more internal and not as socially, I don't want to generalize, but I am, I guess. But because writers spend a lot of time, you know, kind of one-on-one and a lot of alone time, their social skills sometimes need, you know, a little sharpening when they leave the house.
So, I mean, like, a lot of these actors are just in ridiculous shape. So imagine if you went to dinner with them, you get to dessert. You order the chocolate fudge sundae, and they just say, "No, I'll pass. I'll have, you know, more celery or something like that."
I think everybody I've ever been to dinner with has said that. I can be honest with you. Some of them are in great shape. Some of them are not as focused on that. Listen, sometimes the shape you're in determines the kinds of roles you're going to get, too. So. Yeah. I can't speak for actors, but maybe they feel like if they change their physical appearance, they're not going to be hired to do what they do. So I don't know, but yeah,
a lot of A-list actors, there must be in the top 0.1% of male figures just by the six pack and the shredding, or maybe they're just doing something crazy before the movie, like a week or two. But
it's the magic of movies, right? So it's So they're gonna work out, you know, a few months before the production starts. Once the production ends, they're eating again. You know, they're not staying in that. Yeah, I mean, believe me, they're, you know, I'm trying to think of an example of an actor that packed on. You know, I think Mark Wahlberg, he'll pack on either more weight or he'll slim down. He's always in shape, right?
Yeah.
But he's going even a little further with that, and he's really making, you know, specific modifications to his body in terms of weight and the way it looks. So, you know, it fluctuates depending on the part. But yeah. I wouldn't say all actors are necessarily dialed into taking care of themselves or eating right, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. I think they're very dedicated to their craft. So when they're working, they're that way. But I think, you know, they're just like anybody else when you don't have to show up on screen and be looking your absolute best, I think they, you know, they're going to cheat more.
So we've spent the first 15 minutes talking about the food industry. So let's go back to you and you as a producer. So you're a very interesting producer in that you go for non-low-hanging fruit. You picked a project, I believe, Hacksaw Ridge, and the process took something like 14 years or something like that. And you're also attracted to scripts that are difficult. Do you think that's a bit risky as a producer?
Yeah, I mean, it's completely risk. I mean, risky in what sense would you say? You
just
mean financially
in terms of
risky?
Like career success, if you're going for the things that require more intellectual thought processes when you're watching them.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you factor in the amount of time it takes, then that it does affect your success. But I think ultimately the fact that these are the films that I've made, that's actually increased my success at the same time. So there's a trade-off there. You're absolutely right. There's a trade-off there. So in not being attracted to the most commercial projects, yeah, I mean, I'm a producer who has to, you know, have a lot of projects in development. So I'm making movies, you know, these movies that are more difficult to get made, I've got to probably have more of them to increase the amount of films being made in a period of time. So that is true. I do probably at any given time have about 20 projects, you know, that I'm working on. So
I find that hard to relate to because each of these projects seems multiple millions of pounds or whatever. And then you've got all this cast involved in each one of these projects. How in the world do you organize your day around that?
Yeah, well, you know, they're not all in production. So, you know, you might have one or I've been fortunate to have actually two movies in production simultaneously, which is really unusual. But if you're lucky enough to experience that, it's crazy. I did not sleep at all. You know, on one show we were doing nights and then on the other show we were doing days. So you just don't sleep. But no, you're not actively producing the project, each project every day. One day might be dedicated to one project, or maybe the morning is dedicated to one project. The afternoon is dedicated to another project. Yeah, I'm breaking up. I'm doing it in quadrants of time, and I'm servicing each project. I'm not. It's like spinning plates. It's like I'm spinning this plate, and then I go over to this one. I'm spinning that plate, and then I go back to this one, and I spin that plate. It's not. I'm not spinning them all at once. You know.
In one of your other YouTube interviews, you mentioned that your first love was directing. What was it that made you change your mind about that would not be your best success for the other producing?
You know, I think maybe I just felt like that wasn't necessarily my talent. It took me, to be honest, you know, I didn't have a lot of belief in myself, honestly, when I first started out. I was very insecure, and I didn't really have a lot of people around me who were being helpful or supportive. So it took me a while to kind of find the path. So, when I was a kid, I, you know, didn't know one thing about the film business, and I just naturally, you know, I was making films in my backyard. So I was lighting, you know, things on fire. I was flooding little miniature villages. I was hiring, you know, all the kids in the neighborhood. You know, I was using my garage as a soundstage and, you know, dumping water on them because they were in a sinking ship or something. So I was, you know, I was doing all the Super 8 filmmaking, you know, and I can't say the films I was making were winning awards or anybody was taking notice of them. So maybe I thought, okay, you know, maybe it's easier. Maybe it's a little easier to go down the producer track. So that's just what happened. But, you know, I'm not so sure it was so well thought out. It was just kind of like I got on the track and then it started to sort of lead me down a certain path.
Mm-hmm. Can you just let us know how much of the movie Hacksaw Ridge depended on, well, how much of that did you organize? So were you involved in like 50% of organizing everything together? Or?
Well, yeah, I'm involved in 100%. So I'm what you would refer to as a creative producer. So I'm the first one on scene. So in the case of Hacksaw Ridge, I was actually the first one who found the project. This I was shooting a film and my second unit director knew of the story, and I was on set one day and we were on break and he said, look, I've had such a great time working with you guys on this film. I want to bring another project to you. And he started to tell me the story of Desmond T. Doss, a conscientious objector in World War II who went into World War II, refused to bear arms. He was a Seventh-day Adventist, and he did not want to touch a rifle or kill anybody or shoot a gun. So he became a medic and was sent to the front lines because that's where those guys go. And he was tending to American and Japanese wounded. And amazing story. I'm listening to this story. It just completely blew me away. I had no idea why this hadn't been made into a movie yet. And I took the story and I brought it to my boss, to the company that I was working for at the time. And from that point on, we acquired the rights. So I was involved in all of the contractual rights agreements, in pitching the story, in bringing in the financing, in developing the screenplay, successive, you know, over the years. You said 14 years, it was roughly about 14 years. So in that period of time, we were setting the project up. We had it set up at Walden Media at one point in time. We were talking to actors, in fact, a Harry Potter actor, Daniel, I'm just blanking on his name, Daniel, Harry Potter. He came in, I'm just on the tip of my tongue. Anyway, I mean, this guy's one of the most famous actors in the entire world. The meeting with him in the hotel was amazing. Daniel Radcliffe. The meeting with Daniel Radcliffe was incredible. I mean, everybody in this hotel was enamored in his presence because he was Harry Potter, you know, and this is like all their kids know about him. All the adults know about, you know, this guy's a major star. You know, it's, you don't really put that two and two together, maybe. But, you know, this guy's a huge star around the globe. So he was interested at one point. There were other directors other than Mel Gibson interested. So I'm the point guy for this entire process, along with the team that I'm working with. Of course, it's not just me. I'm working with other producers. But for the first 14 years, a very close-knit group of people. And then when Mel Gibson came on board, obviously the team expands and you hire people for the production. But I'm involved in the entire process right up to the release of the film. That's what I do as a creative producer.
So after how many years does Mel Gibson get involved?
Well, we had actually brought the project to him a number of times, maybe two or three times before he actually committed to it. So on like the third or fourth time, he finally committed to the project. And then from that point on, things move pretty quickly. Once you have a director, you know, a substantial director like Mel involved, then you can go out to casting, then you can raise financing, additional financing, because the financing we had raised up to that point was only for the development of the screenplay, not for the actual production. So once then you bring on the elements, then you can go out and you can raise more financing to produce the film.
So when the film is being made and directed, is Mel Gibson 100% involved?
Absolutely. Yeah. When you direct a film, there's very little else you can do. And when you're right. In production, anyway, you're there on set, you know, you're working maybe, I mean, a director's work. I mean, I don't even know if a director sleeps more than a few hours every night because they are doing rewrites sometimes late at night when everybody goes home. Sometimes they're watching dailies, which are the scenes that we have already filmed that have been transferred or uploaded to a site where they can be viewed to see that everything looks good. So, a director is doing a lot of work in his downtime in the production, during the production of the film. And production schedules are maybe anywhere from like 19 days to maybe 40 days to maybe 60 days on a really long show. So that's kind of the period of time that a director is fully immersed. And then the editor takes over from that point on, does a few weeks of editing. The editing process is already going on as you're making the film too. So the editor is getting those dailies as well, and he's cutting them together and he's assembling the film. And that's something else the director might also be looking at, late at night, you know, as he's making the film, as he's shooting the film. So it's pretty intense.
So is Mel Gibson, he's looking at the current day's footage and then thinking about what he wants to reshoot. And then he's planning tomorrow's shoot and what the camera angles will be and what the scene will flow like. And I guess he's got friends to help him with the logistics of cars driving around and lighting and all that kind of stuff that's really hard to control sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that stuff, I mean, some of that stuff is done in second unit, what you call second unit. So you actually have another camera, another director, another small, you know, group of people who go out and shoot like a car chase. Like when you don't need the primary actors, like, you know, when you're using stunt personnel or doubles, you don't need, you can use a second unit director in those situations. So a lot of that stuff though is sort of worked out before you reach the set. But yeah, like you say, he's probably focused more on his shot list the night before. So, you know, even a lot of that might be worked out already, but he's going to be working with the cinematographer. That's going to be his right-hand man. So that's the guy that's going to then go, you know, light the set and make sure everything's going to be in place in terms of the lighting and the camera positioning. And then they're going to coordinate with the second unit director or, you know, the personnel, you know, shoot that sequence the next day. So yeah, it's basically that type of preparation, final preparation.
So was the script pretty much set in stone, or did Mel Gibson change some of the script or screenplay?
Yeah, the script goes through a process of development, I'd say, the entire time. So you develop the script in pre-production, and then when you reach set, there are pages generated for that day's work. So it might be pages, you know, 6, 7, 6, 8, and page 120. Because you're not doing the pages in order, you're doing the locations in order. So if you're at a school and the school is on page 6, 8, and page 120, you're shooting those pages that day or that week in that one location. So you get these pages, they have the dialogue. If you see something in the dialogue that needs to be changed, you might have to have the writer come in and do a rewrite real quick. Now, a lot of times, you know, that hopefully is going to happen the night before the pages are generated. But I've received pages day of the shoot that needed to be rewritten. So you are literally in this rewriting, you know, this rewriting process the whole time.
Yeah. So in Hacksaw Ridge, in order of most pressure, who are the five top most pressure jobs on the job?
Well, I'd say the director is probably under the most pressure because it's really, you know, he's making all the decisions. So I'd say that the producer, you know, I'm always feeling an immense amount of pressure when I'm on set. So there's not a lot of time to sort of take it all in and be grateful. You know, I talk about being grateful. That's when I really need to sort of take a step back, because I'm so immersed in the moment and I'm so focused on what the issues are that I have to deal with that it can be very intense. And also you're not sleeping much, and you know, you're just working successive days. The days are sort of bleeding in to each other. You're not really eating right. You're maybe sleeping in a hotel bed, so you're not getting the best sleep. So this really kind of tests everybody's, you know, mettle a little bit. You know, I'd say the cinematographer, that's a pretty intense job because he's got to make sure the image is going to be perfect. That there are no issues with the image, right? So that's not something that you can go back and redo necessarily. Sometimes you can.
The cameraman? But if you're,
yeah, the cinematographer, he's got to make sure that everything he's doing is going to be right. You know, a lot of things can be fixed in post-production. The sound guy, there's a guy that's got a really important job. You can't go back and get the sound again, right? So it's everything that you can't redo. Now, you can loop sound, that's true, but you have to make sure that you get the ambient sound when you're at the location, because that's hard to recreate. So, there are all these little things you have to make sure you're grabbing when you're in the location. So establishing shots is another thing that you run into. It's like filmmakers sometimes aren't thinking, oh yeah, get a wide shot or get an establishing. I've run into this on films before. And, you know, before we leave the location, I'll say, did you get the establishing shot? You know, make sure you've got everything you need, you know, because if we don't have all the pieces, we're not going to be able to fix anything. So those things are nerve wracking, you know, making sure the picture's right, make sure the sound's right, you know, just making sure all the technical aspects are correct. I'd say those are really the important positions on the film. You know, the guy that's spending the money, so that could be a studio executive, that could be an independent financier, that could be the executive producer. You know, he's nervous because he's watching hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars of his money being spent. So that guy's probably pretty nervous too. So those are probably the pressure positions on the film.
So when does the pressure come off? After the Rotten Tomato reviews or I don't know where people look for the reviews. Is that when, like, if you see like 7 out of 10 on IMDb 1 year later, for me, that's the pressure's off.
Well, you want the film to be, you know, financially successful too. So we can't lose sight of that, because, you know, in the film business, you've got, you know, there are different measuring sticks for success. So yeah, you rightfully say that, you know, I mean, I'm a creative producer. So the first measure of success for me that is that the film that I made is, you know, it works creatively, right? And that people, you know, it works for me, and not only for me, but most importantly, it works for the audience. Okay. So not even so much for critics, although you want critics to embrace the film, but you really want the audience to be the ones who embrace the film. Okay. Because there's, you know, critics, especially with comedies, you know, you'll have one critic review. Comedy is so subjective, so it's hard to rely on a critic's opinion about a comedy. But yeah, you want everybody to embrace the film. And, you know, does the pressure ever really come off? I mean, I think somebody said once, oh gosh, who was it? I can't remember who said it, but a famous producer said, yeah, if I don't look nervous and worried, I'm not doing my job. Right. So I think that, yeah, maybe when the film comes out and it's been well reviewed and it's making a lot of money, maybe then I can take a deep breath. But you gotta understand, like, I'm the kind of professional who's so hard charging and wants everything to be so great and trying to go over the top with everything I'm doing that, it's hard to finally get to that point where I sort of, you know, relax and just let it all go. But, you know, once the opening weekend hits and the film's either a success or not a success, I think that's the point where you exhale and either move on to the next one or, take stock in your success and try to replicate it, I guess.
So approximately how many hours a week are you working on movies?
I'm working all day and night long. So I, you know, I don't have any kids and I have a girlfriend, but I'm not married. So I'll take a night or two off to have dinner with her or, you know, something like that. We're actually, we're going away this weekend. We're going to take a trip out of town, but and I'll be working on the plane. I'll be working when we get to where we're going. So I'm going to be, yeah, I mean, look, I don't work in a coal mine. I'm not lifting heavy boxes. This is not hard labor. Okay. So I'm not complaining about the work, but, yeah, the work's going on all day and night long, you know, and it's not work that I'm not, you know, into doing necessarily. If I have to do a lot of reading, you know, screenplays or whatever, that's work. Yeah. If I have to watch a movie that I'm not really into watching, but I have to watch it because I need to know what's going on, you know, with movies, I'll watch it, you know, and that feels like work. But if it's a movie that I'm enjoying, now all of a sudden it becomes a little more of enjoyment instead of work. And so, you know, so again, my work is not that intense like other people's work. I'm not an accountant. I'm not just working with numbers. It's a little more creative. It's a little more interesting. So, yeah, I'm working. Like after this interview, I'll go on my walk. I'll work out. I'll come back. I'll work again for a few hours. I'll have dinner, come back, work again, you know, till bedtime. But that's basically how it goes. It's going all day long. In my case, it's all day long.
So it sounds like 70 or 80 hours a week, but that's understandable because your work and your hobbies are sort of blurred together. So you enjoy what you're doing. So it's not really work, it's just your hobby, which is great. I
But you
mean,
know, and to, but yeah, and to be successful at a high level, you have to put that amount of work in. That's how it goes. So.
I mean, I'd love to be able to do this podcasting like 50% of my time, but I'm just very time strapped with other things that pay the bills right now, So, but that's the dream, isn't it? To do something that pays your expenses, but you love doing it and it's your hobby. So,
Yeah. I mean, I'm fortunate, you know, I can supplement my income with consulting as well, which I have a booming consulting business, and I only wish I could get back to doing more consulting. So it's kind of almost like the opposite situation that you're in, but 'cause I enjoy working with clients and they get so much out of it, and people come to me and they tell me how much I've helped them and moved them forward and, you know, gotten their screenplays to big producers who are considering, you know, their work, and they're getting movies. So I really, there's a lot of satisfaction in the consulting side of things. On the movie side of things, when it takes 14 years to get a movie realized, you know, you're just not a lot of satisfaction. So that's what's so great about the consulting. In addition to financially, you know, being a financial support system for me, which is something, by the way, that I recommend everybody who's a creative has. You need to have some financial support system. You can't just go out there and starve yourself. That's not, I mean, you can, but that's just not a good strategy, right? So you want to lock down, you know, like when I first started in the business, I used to work in the restaurant business. So I would work during the day and then I could go work at night in the restaurant. And that was my financial support system, you know, because I was working for free in the movie business at that point in time. So I think you kind of have to have that. And then it puts a little less stress on the financials. But yeah, you're gonna have to be splitting your time probably 50-50 when you're just getting going, until you can turn your hobbies into something that makes you a lot of money.
I think that's the key thing that a lot of people don't understand is that you're basically doing like a full-time job that you might not like just to keep you going, and then the creative stuff is a bonus. And that just seems to, a lot of people don't have that drive, that passion, that motivation to really make it that way.
That's right. Well, that's why a lot of people fall by the wayside who are pursuing careers in the industry, I imagine, is because, and I mean, I don't just imagine this because I preach this, you have to keep trying, you have to keep submitting, you have to keep querying producers. I mean, I get a 10 no's, 20 no's every day. You know, people tell me no all the time. No is, you know, people passing on my projects and getting, you know, rejected is happening on a regular basis. That's the daily grind. That's what it looks like. So I'm expecting that. So that's not where, you know, if you let that get to you, if you focus on the no's, that's going to wear you down, and that's going to discourage you, and that's not going to give you that drive that you're going to need to keep pushing through. So you really have to be pushing through at all times. Right when you think you're going to quit is right when you're about to have some success many times. So I'm always talking about, you know, trying to build the wherewithal so you have that passion, so you have that drive. If you can't muster that, if you can't find that, if you can't figure that out, it's not likely you'll be successful, because you have to be willing to do the things that other people are not willing to do, you know, or you have to be able to get into the mindset or set yourself up in a situation where you have the, you know, financial support, and then you can focus on the more creative aspects. But you do have to have that worked out, and you do have to manage that. So, yeah, you know, writers and creatives spend a lot of time inside their heads, right? We spend a lot of time, as I mentioned before, one-on-one with the computer. And sometimes you got to get out of your house and you got to switch that up. You got to break out of that, and you got to exercise your brain. Because that will reinvigorate it. It will give you new ideas. It will change. You know, sometimes I just have to go to sleep at the end of a long day where I'm discouraged, right? And I wake up the next morning, I'm refreshed, I'm ready to go at it again. So, but you have to be aware of when you're hitting that point and understand not to. I think when I was a little kid, I used to get very frustrated in my homework and I just couldn't understand it. I wasn't great at school, to be honest with you. And my mother would just say, take a break, like, you know, just relax, you know. I'd be getting all worked up. She was right, you know, and I'd take a break and walk away from it, come back an hour later, and then all of a sudden I'd be able to do it, you know? So again, we're like our own worst enemy. I preach this. Like it's not only that dialogue that's going on inside your head that's, you know, talking smack to you. It's that, you know, we tend to get in our own way. We tend to not believe in ourselves enough, and we tend to get discouraged, and we tend to create meaning out of, you know, and that's our reaction, of course, to things, creating this meaning, you know, oh, maybe it means I'm not good enough, right? No, it just means you're not trying hard enough. Okay. It might mean you have to improve on what you're doing, but get feedback from people, get out of the house, talk to people, have them look at your stuff, have them give you feedback on your filmmaking or whatever it is. Take that in, process that, figure out what's useful, and then implement it, right? Learn. So there's no failure. It's just learning. That's what failure is. Failure is just learning and then making adjustments to your approach.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So I've noticed that you've mentioned in a couple of other YouTube videos, I recommend people watch them, Barry, because definitely I'm not covering all the things in those videos. You prefer classic movies. Could you expand more on that?
Yeah, I mean, I prefer watching classic films that I know will likely be good. So they maybe have... you know, this reputation of being good films, right? So I'm not watching a lot of, let's just say, I'm not randomly watching classic films, okay? Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. So I prefer to do that as opposed to randomly watching current films, which haven't stood the test of time yet. And I have to slog through the ones that are, you know, not so good to get to the good ones. So I don't mind watching a really great current film, but because they haven't sort of gone through that test, it's more random, and I'm watching a lot of, so that's I'm just trying to put in context my comment. So my comment is that I prefer to watch these classic films as opposed to having to sit here and watch all the new releases and try to figure out what's going to become a classic. If that makes sense.
Yeah, I find that when I'm watching a lot of times on Netflix, there's maybe one out of 10 that actually captures my attention, and there's even less than that in terms of TV series that actually capture my attention. And if they do capture my attention, it's for like the first one or two episodes, you know. So it's hard to find stuff that's, I mean, I think I'm probably kind of particular because I just find that a lot of, especially movies that try and talk about computer programming and hacking and all this kind of stuff. I'm a software developer, so like they're so shallow in terms of like this computer language talk stuff, you know. So like, I don't really know what the point of what was my point there.
Well, you appreciate certain films for their authenticity. And yeah, you're good at, you know, obviously because you have a certain, you know, skill and you're in that line of work, you know when something's authentic or not, right? So this is something that we're always trying to do in filmmaking, right? And that's all about engagement. So you're saying once you are watching something and it's not tracking as like being authentic to you, you disengage from it. And that's a great point, right? So what we're trying to do with filmmaking all the time is we're trying to approximate reality in like every way. You know, you want the storyline to be plausible, like I always say, I'm the plausibility police when I'm reading a screenplay. So you want the character's actions to feel like they're real, to feel like that's exactly how someone would act in this very situation, right? You want the scenery to look real, right? If the background looks fake or if it's plastic plants or something, you disengage. You go, wait, that's like a fake plant in the background. And all of a sudden you disengage from what's going on in the foreground, which is what you should be engaged in, which is the dialogue and the action, right? So what you're saying is very smart. It's exactly how filmmaking works. And it's what I'm trying to do as a producer. I'm trying to, you know, part of my job is trying to make sure that everything I'm reading, watching, hearing is tracking as real or tracking as authentic. And that's what you're saying. It's like you're watching a film and if it's dealing with computer hacking or programming or anything like that, you're the person in the audience that knows when they're like, you know, they're not being authentic or they're making something up. Or so for you as an, now other people in the audience, they're not going to care about that, but they might care about something else. They might say, oh, this guy's wife just died. It sure doesn't seem very sad about it. Like, you know, in life, you would be mourning some, your wife died, you know, unless he murdered her. Right. So there might be a reason. Mm-hmm. If there's a reason, that's okay, of course. But if then there's no reason, you're going to say, wait a minute, that didn't make sense. This isn't good. This, right? So this is how we're judging screenplays. But yeah, that's something I'm looking at in movies. I'm saying, does this feel authentic to me? Am I connecting to this because because movies are asking you to buy into a reality. And that's occurring. So in great screenwriting, that's happening in the first, like on the first four or five pages. It's almost like an initiation, and you're being brought into this reality, and you want to sort of explain how that reality is going to work. TV series work like this too. It's like they're building a world, and the world has certain rules to it. And those rules are going to need to remain consistent throughout the piece, right? Throughout the movie or the series. Because it's what you are buying into. You're buying into that, oh, in this world, so a character can do this. And, you know, like if you're watching a cartoon, you're watching Roadrunner and he fires a gun at a character, the character just has like black and, you know, it's the character doesn't die. The character has like a, you know, this blown out cartoon look and maybe some singe and some smoke, but maybe the next scene, the character's okay, right? So you understand, oh, in this world, that's how that works. But you have to buy into that. You have to accept that first and mm-hmm. for it to then not disengage you from what's going on, right? So this is like almost like, you know, scientifically how it's all working, and it all relates to engagement, and that's exactly what I think you're referring to.
Yeah, like in Hacksaw Ridge, you felt engaged because bullets did what bullets did. When you look at some of these superhero movies, I'll just pick on Iron Man, he will based on the laws of physics, it's going to hurt him just as much if he gets hit with a massive rock without the armor or the armor in, because he's still going to decelerate or accelerate at the same speed. So it's like there's no sense of danger in those kind of things. And when I look at the movies that I'll watch maybe four, five, six times again and again and again, versus a lot of these modern movies, which are basically maybe suitable for me for one watching, is that a lot of these ones that I'll watch again and again, the journey from normal to extraordinary is longer, versus just going from maybe 5 minutes into the plot, you have the normal, and then 8 or 9 minutes later, you've got the superheroes and are doing all those fancy things. So I think in a movie that I've got like maybe half the movie building up, movies like Contact with Michelle Pfeiffer, is it, I think? There's a few Tom Cruise movies like Oblivion, where you've got this long build-up. Batman Begins. I think a lot of movies nowadays, they don't have that development. The Matrix, the first Matrix, that's for me the most exciting part. Limitless as well. Another movie, Transcendence, there's a long build-up. But even with Transcendence, it moved so quickly from... Like, if that movie Transcendence would spend another, say, 10 or 20 minutes from the build-up from when he gets uploaded to the development. But there's such a big, it's such a quick jump from he gets uploaded and then he basically makes this massive, complex, you know, biolab. I don't know what the rush is. What is the rush from producers nowadays to get from this, you know, quick fix into the movie, you know?
Yeah, I think, you know, you hear this a lot, and I've never completely bought into this, but, you know, it started way back in the 80s when MTV came on the scene. Now, you know, you're too young to remember this. I'm old enough to remember it. Probably a lot of people listening to your podcast don't understand, you know, this whole watershed moment actually in filmmaking, and it happened with MTV. And the thing with MTV was you know, music videos with lots of quick cutting, right? And right at about that time is when Michael Bay came on the scene. And if you watch Michael Bay's earlier films, there's a lot of quick cutting. It's almost like frenetic cutting. And this is something that really never, you know, you didn't really see in filmmaking too much. But it started at about that point in time. And then what we started to evolve into was that there started to be this thing people were saying that audiences don't have patience anymore to sit through that buildup. That audiences want to, exactly, right? So it's almost like Hollywood's trying to figure out what the audience wants, but they're getting it wrong, right? And then they're falling into this trap, which is what you're saying, which is like they feel like, you know, when they test screen the film, they hand you a card with all these questions and it'll say, where do you feel like the movie moved slow? Where do you feel like the movie moved fast? And everybody weighs in. And then they read the cards and everybody... Yeah, but they're not saying what's the best part or what's the worst part. And you're not asking, right? And this is like the flaw in test screening, questionnaires. They're not saying, does that hurt the movie? Does that help the movie? Did you like it? Were you impatient? Like, how you question the audience, too, is going to mean a lot in terms of what you're getting back and how you're adjusting. So what the tendency is to just, because I've been in this process and I've seen how it can be flawed, this is how I'm surmising this happens. Audiences say, yeah, move slow in this part. So they go back into the editing room. And even though that part may have been a part the audience was engaged with, because that's the key, that's the real question. Were you ever disengaged from the film at any point in time? Yes. Okay. What scene? This scene. Okay. Why? It was moving too slow. Okay. So you'd have to go through that questioning process to understand, but they don't. Okay. Movie slow here. Okay. Cut it quicker, right? Go back into the editing room and cut. Like when this, you know, this guy finishes his sentence, cut a lot quicker, right? So now they're tightening, they're cutting. And then it starts to lead to this, you know, idea that, oh, the audience doesn't have any patience. Let me put it to you this way. For a period of time, we thought maybe that's true. And then what happened? Movies started to get a lot longer all of a sudden. Now, how did that happen? What happened to that MTV generation? What happened to the quick cutting? What happened to nobody has any patience? All these superhero movies are 3 hours long, right? So does any of it mean anything? Not really. It's not the length of the film. It's the engagement. It's the storytelling, right? Am I engaged? Am I connected? And am I, you know, following the storytelling? Do I believe the bullets are real or this is fake? Or am I buying into it and saying, all right, I know it's fake, but that's okay. I'm going to focus on the characters in the story, right? As opposed to, hey, those bullets, you know, as opposed to, let's say, the plausibility of a comic book film, right? Which, you know, plausibility probably doesn't play a huge part in the development of a film like that. You know, there are other things, perhaps. I'm no expert on those films. I haven't made one yet. But, but I suspect that they're just not focused on plausibility a whole lot. I think the first Iron Man I love because it's like, you know, Downey's like a real character, right? It's like you have, there's the film's grounded in something you can attach to. Yeah. And that's really important. There needs to be a grounding. Films need to have a grounding element. You know, even comedies, in a comedy, you need the straight, you know, you have Laurel and Hardy, right? One is the comedic foil, the other one is the straight man. In a comedic film, there needs to be like a straight element. If there isn't if there aren't straight characters and then comedic characters or foils, then there needs to be something in the film that grounds it in a reality that we then can play the comedy off of. So that's really important.
This is an amazing interview. I've only asked 30% of the questions I wanted to ask you.
Okay, all right. We'll do it again.
Yeah, Yeah, well, man, it's tough. It's tough to fit.
Why talk Hardy, a lot? I tend to go on.
This is great. It's great. It's great for your thought. Definitely do another podcast sooner rather than later. I mean, Laurel and Hardy, honestly, I've watched some of the episodes between 20 and 20 or 30 times. What is it about Laurel and Hardy that just makes it transcend time versus even the most popular funny movies there is today?
Wait, ask that question again.
What is it that gives Laurel and Hardy the staying power?
To a film?
Well, the comedy Laurel and Hardy. Why does it keep never get boring? That comedy.
Oh, because we all relate to it so well. I mean, comedy. You know, not we all, but I think the human condition is comedy. And we're all inside the human condition. And so I think that I think audiences really connect to laughing because laughing is such a natural emotion that I think when something's funny, unless it's just completely out of context or occurring, you know, like in another culture or something, most all cultures find the same things funny, right? So that's kind of interesting. Not everything. But when you're talking about the human condition, I think you're talking about something that's very universally applicable. And so I think the staying power for comedies is because comedies tend to focus more on the human condition. It's like when you see Harold Lloyd, you know, hanging from that clock, you know, in downtown LA or whatever, that's just never going to get old, right? That's always like, whoa, like he's hanging from a clock, you know, 20 stories above the street. And it's, you know, and it's like, it's comedic too, because of the way he's, you know, performing the whole stunt and, you know, the music and the movie and the cutting and all that, you know, it's got a certain tone to it. So, I just think it's these setups, these set pieces are things that are just very easy, very simple. You know, when you see the front of the house fall down and miss him because he's standing in the doorway, you know, when is that not going to be funny? Like that's just always going to be funny because somebody narrowly avoiding having a house fall on them is just always going to be funny, I think. Yeah. So, I mean, I just think there are these things in comedy that are just so relatable that we're just so connected to them that they transcend time. You know, whereas maybe in dramas, you know, if you look at older films, like the pattern of dialogue and the pattern of how people speak is different too sometimes. Sometimes it's like snappier, or it's just, you know, the way we talk today is you look at dialogue today and you compare it to dialogue in the 30s and 40s and it's totally different, you know, and that's a whole nother thing.
Yeah, I actually knew somebody who knew Laurel and Hardy. And he says to me, like, I think he was like a helper or something around the movie sets. And he says, like, when you see Laurel and Hardy and doing the acting and in real life, they're exactly the same. They're always joking, you know. They would just live the comedy in real life. They were always telling jokes, you know. And I think...
Yeah, I met Jim Carrey, you know, so I met Jim Carrey once. And I was at my friend's house. Jim walked in the room. And this is right when Ace Ventura came out. So Jim was he was becoming a big star. So he was a star, but he wasn't at the level, you know, that he finally achieved. But my friend had a wood floor that was really polished. It was all polished up. And Jim wasn't wearing any shoes, right? So when he hit the wood floor, he put his arms behind his back and he started to skate like a skater on the wood floor. And I will never forget that. I mean, how he just saw this wood floor and he just started to skate like he was a skater on ice. And I mean, man, if that guy isn't like one of the most talented people I've ever met. But you could see it's in his fiber. It's in the fiber of his being. He is going to be funny no matter what, you know, was just walking into a room, sees this shiny, you know, slippery floor, and he just starts to skate on it. And it was great. You know, I never forgot that. And I think that's what you're saying. It's like, you know, these guys become you know, who they become. And by the way, not all comedians are, you know, I was friends with Rodney Dangerfield for the last 10 years of his life. And Rodney Dangerfield was one of the funniest people I've ever known. And, but, you know, off camera, Rodney was a very serious individual, was not cracking jokes all the time, was not always, you know, performing. He was a very, very different kind of person. Almost the complete opposite of a happy, you know, fun, go lucky person, an incredible man. But you know, he and an amazing talent, but Rodney was a different character, you know, than the one. And I knew him at a certain period of his life, so I can't speak for his entire life. But you know, the point in time that I knew him, he was very different from his public persona. So sometimes you see that as well.
I think to be a successful comedian, you have to be extremely intelligent, and especially, I think my friend told me that Laurel was the guy who was always acting stupid. He was actually he was the genius behind a lot of those jokes. And if you study Laurel Hardy, the timing, the camera shots, everything is so precise, and the timing, it's hard to imagine. And Jim Carrey, obviously he looks pretty silly on the camera, but the amount of effort he's so sharp, Jim Carrey. I think once somebody asked him about Mike Tyson and why people were scared of him, and Jim Carrey just immediately came out with like the eyes or something like that, and then he just rattled off a whole bunch of reasons on the fly. So that's just an insane level of intelligence, I think.
I think all these comedians are highly, highly intelligent, because you know why? I think they're observers. You know, they observe life. And they're able to see things because they're observing life. They see things that we maybe take for granted or don't recognize in the moment. So they're very present, I think, in terms of how they move through life. And they're very observant. And I think that when you take in a lot of information, when you have awareness, I think awareness is a key thing in life. When you have this awareness, the kind of awareness comedians, you know, your instincts are way sharper too. So you're not just intellectually smarter, you're instinctually smarter because you've taken in more information. You're paying attention to more information. And then when you have more information, then your problem solving abilities improve, right? So I was talking about, you know, the tenets of problem solving. One, identify the problem. Number two, research the problem. But if you innately have the research, if you innately have the information, you're going to be able to figure things out. So that's another quality I notice, you know, in comedians. They're very observant.
Mm-hmm. I want to be respectful of your time. I know you've got a busy day ahead of you.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, anything you want to share with the audience before we finish the first episode?
Look, I just say just generally talking about success, right? So, you know, I've had some measure of success in my life. I intend on having more. I'm still working very hard every day at it. But for me, it was always, you know, I say this, one of the greatest obstacles you're ever going to face is yourself. Right. So a lot of times it's getting out of your own way to become successful. And it's getting back to that inner voice and your story. It's really you really have the tools. So I want to say to your audience, right, that you have the tools to become successful. OK. And if you've run into challenges or failures or things like that, I want you to think about what you did and how you reacted. And I want you to keep in mind that everything that happens in your life, the reality, the life that you're creating is created by you and by you for the most part, only you. And it's how you're reacting to things. All right. And so if you keep those things in mind, you're going to find success. So I think just listening to me talk about my experiences, I've tried to sort of weave in these tools and these things that you can do to help improve your success, sharpen, you know, what your inner voice is saying and turn it around and make it more positive. I think if you've listened to everything I've said, all of those things have helped me become successful, and they can help you become successful too.
Well, our audience are looking forward to more time with you, Steve. Please go check all his films that he's working on and come out with, and look forward to talking to you again soon, my friend.
Yeah, people can reach me at longitudeentertainment.com. So that's my website, www.longitude, all spelled out, longitudeentertainment.com. And they can connect with me on LinkedIn. I connect with everybody there, and I'm posting a lot on LinkedIn and Twitter. So, you know, you can see me there as well. And if anybody needs any consulting, you know, reach out too. And we can talk about, you know, what your needs are and how I can help you.
Right. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Bye, everybody. See you next time.